From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, GM's CEO faces a tough Senate grilling on the ignition switch recall.
Our job today is to learn as much as possible about the failures of General Motors and the regulators to keep unsuspecting daughters, fathers, wives, and sons safe.
Plus, President Obama comes to Ann Arbor to push for a higher minimum wage. We'll hear from a restaurateur who wants exactly that.
It's merely a political question, and it's a political question that is playing with a lot of people's lives.
And as they tear down Detroit's Brewster Douglas projects, we look at the past.
The houses were well built, they were sturdy, they were concrete block. I know people that remember those years very well and remember that as really good family-oriented housing.
And the future of that downtown site. Those stories and more today. President Obama visits the University of Michigan to push the Fair Minimum Wage Act. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Welcome. At this very moment, the president is on campus in Ann Arbor talking to students and invited guests about the bill that would gradually raise the federal minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $10.10 by 2016. Senate Democrats are planning votes on the bill, but Republicans are working to block it. Michigan's minimum wage is $7.40 an hour. Other groups are working to gather petition signatures to boost that. Later this hour, we get a live report from the president's campus visit. We'll find out what he said and whether Michigan might see more presidential visits in the near future. But first, Paul Saginaw is co-founder of Zingerman's Delicatessen in Ann Arbor. He has been pushing to increase the minimum wage, and he's committed to paying Zingerman's workers above the minimum wage. Paul, welcome to Stateside.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So why are you so strongly committed to paying above the minimum wage to your workers?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is a purely business reason. We believe that a well-paid staff that isn't constantly struggling to make ends meet, to be on a, you know, somewhat kind of firm financial ground, has a lot more energy and focus on the job at hand. And also, if they have a well-paid job in a workplace where they're being treated with dignity and given meaningful work and there's a sense of community, our turnover is a lot lower. We spend a lot of money training people. The training process is ongoing at Zingerman's and certainly very intense when you first start. So if we can cut our costs of sourcing and screening and hiring and onboarding people and have much lower turnover, that certainly contributes to a healthy bottom line.
It's clear you feel strongly about this. At the same time, though, we see many other restaurant owners feeling the minimum wage boost would be a disaster. I noticed the Free Press recently had an op-ed from the president and CEO of the Michigan Restaurant Association, and here's his quote about boosting Michigan's minimum wage from $7.40 to $10.10. He said this would push restaurants further to the brink. This would not only increase menu prices and cost Michigan jobs, it would put many restaurants out of business. So how do you reconcile these very differing points of view from folks in the very same field?
Well, I think there's a difference between someone's point of view and a fact. And so I would like to know what is backing up those statements. I don't buy into it. We certainly hear those kinds of statements are bandied about. But I would say show me a study where ever raising the minimum wage has slowed the economy down, has put people out of business, or has lowered job creation. I don't think you can find a legitimate study that does that. A lot of the information that is coming from the Michigan Restaurant Association is coming from one or two think tanks that are funded by the National Restaurant Administration. So, what I would say to those restaurateurs or to the people of the Michigan Restaurant Association is invest in your employees and not in your lobbyists.
Now, let me ask, can a state that is still recovering from a whopping recession, can it weather a 36% hike in the minimum wage?
Well, I certainly think it can. I'm a retailer and we need customers to have money in their pockets in order to come in and make purchases. And I think that raising the minimum wage is going to put more money in people's pockets. And I think they are going to go out and take that and make purchases with it. So I think it's a very healthy way that's going to help drive the economy forward. It's not tax based. We're not asking for a tax increase. It's neutral in that respect. So I very much think that in a state that's trying desperately to recover economically, that it will be a boost. You know, overnight, many, many, many people will be lifted out of poverty. I think that's a really good thing. And I don't think it's really not a economic question. I don't think you're going to find a large group of legitimate economists arguing that this is going to somehow hurt the economic growth. It's merely a political question, and it's a political question that is playing with a lot of people's lives.
Let's talk about other restaurants in Michigan. And I could see where some might say, well, you can pay your workers at Zingerman's the wages you do because you are able to command higher prices, and not every restaurant can. I'm looking at the menu, can get $14 or $15 or $16 for a sandwich. And so what of those ones that aren't in an area that can support that or don't have that kind of reputation that can command those prices?
I don't have the benefit of looking at their financial records. I would venture to guess that their profit margins are larger than ours, and that I don't think that it's – but I don't really know. Mm. What I do know is, and what I do believe is, and I can ask you, would you mind paying a little more
right.
for a McDonald's hamburger if you felt that we were then, you know, helping to promote the human potential around us and not discard it.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
A lot of people go out now, and you find going into restaurants and certainly making fun of it on television shows. People are going in and they're asking about where did the chicken come from and was the animal humanely raised? Right. We're thinking about that a lot. People are concerned about that and willing to pay more for that. How often do they go into the restaurant and say, hey, how much are you paying your dishwashers? How are you treating them? Do they get paid time off when they're sick? Do you provide health insurance for them? I think it's time we started asking those questions. And really, if we raise the public's consciousness and awareness on that, I think people are going to be willing to, if it requires raising the price on some products, I think people are willing to do that.
Let me ask you about the president's visit today to Ann Arbor. Do you think it will change minds about raising the minimum wage?
I certainly hope it will.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not really an optimist, and I'm not really a pessimist. I do like to believe in possibilities, and I sincerely believe in the possibility of people hearing a really compelling message and having an open mind, allowing the fact that to truly listen to what someone's saying and to be willing to change one's opinion based on someone presenting a very compelling argument to them. So I absolutely hope that the president's visit and his message will be heard and will prompt people to write to their representatives and ask Congress to move forward and pass this legislation.
What do you think it will take to really move the needle, not just nationally, but if we look at Lansing? What would it take?
Boy, if I knew that, I wouldn't have to slice corned beef for a living, I think. I don't know what it'll take. I think I would like our society as a whole, our culture, to move back towards one in which a true nuanced debate and dialogue is possible. We've gone so far away from that that the level of civility in the public discourse has gotten so low that I think that we would be better off if we could move back towards being a culture that is willing to, you know, you can have very robust arguments and dialogues, but, you know, let's focus on the idea and not demonize each other. I think what it takes is it takes for all of us to kind of dial it down a bit and be willing to come to the table, especially at those times when you really don't want to, and be willing to have honest, open debate that's based on facts and not on opinions.
So from a big picture view, it sounds like you're asking people to think a little bit more about how much they're willing to spend for goods and services as part of a sort of greater good.
Absolutely. I'm certainly not asking our customers to pay more because we're taking better care of our customers. I think if we want our customers have to believe that they're getting value for their hard-earned dollars, and that we're delivering a very high-quality product, and we're delivering it with a very, very high level of service. But I do want people to be as concerned with the employees that are working in an establishment as they are for the animals that they're eating.
Paul Saginaw is co-founder of Zingerman's in Ann Arbor. It's been good to meet you, and thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for asking me to come in.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Brewster Douglas projects in Detroit were once seen as a shining example of public housing. Those homes opened in 1938 as America's first public housing project built for African Americans. Brewster Douglas went on to become home to names like Diana Ross, Mary Wilson, Florence Ballard, Smokey Robinson, Lily Tomlin, and the project helped launch many blacks into the middle class. Well, now the decaying high-rise buildings that sat empty since 2008 are in the final phase of demolition. The question becomes, what should be done with the site? For the conversation, we welcome June Manning Thomas. She's an urban planner with the University of Michigan's College of Architecture and Urban Planning. And she wrote the book, Redevelopment and Race, Planning a Finer City in Postwar Detroit. It's very good to have you with us, June.
Thank you.
And we are joined by Roy Strickland, who also is with the College of Architecture and Urban Planning at the University of Michigan. Roy, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, June, before we look ahead to what might be built on the Brewster Douglas site, give us a better sense of the history of the Brewster Douglas project. Just what was happening in the 1930s that led to the building of what began as the Brewster Projects?
So the Brewster Douglas Projects, first of all, was built in phases. And the first phase is the phase that Eleanor Roosevelt came to break the ground for. And at that point, really, people were looking for solutions to lack of affordable housing or even any housing because of the Great Depression in the city of Detroit. And so the first housing commissioner, Josephine Goleman, was instrumental in getting the first phase built, and then later phases came. So unfortunately, the first phases were better than the later phases in terms of design and family orientation. So that's why the last phase, which is the high-rise units, turned out to be so difficult in terms of the social concerns that you mentioned.
So it sounds like they started off on the right step. What did the first residents think of their new homes?
So the first residents were really happy to be in those houses. They were considered to be lucky to get into them. The houses were well built. They were sturdy. They were concrete block. They were townhouses and walk-ups of 3 and 4 stories centered on playgrounds. So I've seen many pictures of exactly what they looked like, and I know people that remember those years very well and remember that as really good family-oriented housing.
Roy, tell us about the design of that first phase, and then contrast that. June started to take us there, what was added in 1951 as the Frederick Douglass homes. I'm wondering, what was the development something very, very new in terms of urban planning and architecture in America?
Actually, no. Public housing in its first forms grew from a deep tradition of reform housing in American cities. There were many experiences and experiments in the late 19th and early 20th century on the part of private benefactors who were interested in improving the housing conditions of working class and lower middle class people. Now, these turned out to be very expensive to build and also to maintain. And while they helped improve housing codes and housing legislation that modernized housing for poor and working class people over time, it was very difficult to build such projects at the large scale.
Mm.
And it really wasn't until the federal government entered into housing development under the conditions that June described that we saw large-scale, low-rise garden apartments for poor and working-class people. Now, when I say poor and working-class people, they were defined as worthy by first the private sponsors and later by the federal government, and that there had to be someone in the house working. There had to be an insurance policy or bank account held by the family to demonstrate their credit worthiness. And in the first public housing projects, one had to be an American citizen.
Hmm.
Now, this was at a time, of course, in the early 20th century when there was mass immigration to American cities. So these projects, while they were public, were also somewhat exclusive. And one of the reasons why they were successful in the beginning was that they were highly controlled social environments that the government carefully monitored because it wanted to prove that its housing could work.
It was very invested in that. And at the same time, jobs were being created
exactly.
in the Depression, so these New Deal projects
yes.
were being had. And so that was important, too, to just make this work.
That was one of the major justifications of the program because there was a great deal of suspicion on the part of the private sector about public housing. But in addition to providing housing to tenants, the government justified the building of housing as an economic opportunity tool.
Then as we get into the 50s, how did life change once the high-rises became?
Well, actually, life changed before the high-rises because in the 50s and into the 60s, the standards that Roy just described began to loosen. So the criteria were not quite as strict, and so that was one of the difficulties. And then actually it was Congress that refused to basically give enough money both to build the kind of housing that was the best housing and also to give money that was necessary for maintenance. So you began to see actually a yearly war in Congress over funding of this housing, with mostly conservative forces that were actually either constricting the amount of funds that could be allocated mm-hmm. or else they were putting other restrictions on it. So the movement to high-rise housing was partially a financial decision, but it was partially also a part of the modernist movement in architecture. So basically the idea rose in architecture and urban planning that tall towers were modern and the way to go. And so that was another reason that those were built. Plus, they were cheaper. The way they were built was cheaper.
Well, Roy, Brewster Douglas, this trajectory was seen in other cities as well, right? Like Cabrini Green in Chicago. What would be some other famous American housing projects?
There was Pruitt-Igoe in St. Louis, which was the first public housing project to be demolished. There were many public housing projects in Newark and Philadelphia and Chicago that were torn down. Of the cities, New York has actually been the only one to preserve virtually all of its public housing, with 400,000 households and a waiting list, hold on to your hats, of 140,000 families who desire public housing. And I'll make this point. There's nothing wrong with public housing. And I'll play devil's advocate and go further. There's nothing wrong with high-rise housing if it's well-maintained and managed. And indeed, even in projects that were built in the 1950s and 1960s, when they were new, were well-built and well-maintained, people living in those projects at that time felt lucky. So I think we need to stop blaming the high-rise apartment house for the failure of public housing, and start looking elsewhere. Start looking toward management. Start looking toward maintenance. Start looking toward subsidy and support. These projects failed because of policy decisions, not because of the people who lived in them.
These projects were not slated to be disasters from the get-go, were they?
No. They were meant to be models of urban living. Public housing, unlike private housing, was built for a 50 and 100-year lifespan. These were solid, well-built places.
And June, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree that they were solid and well-built, but I think the problem was that they were not ever given the maintenance that was needed. And quite frankly, a lot of the New York City public housing right now has experienced severe maintenance problems. So I think, you know, we have to, it's true that we can't demonize the housing because there's nothing inherently wrong. But I think, again, in New York City, I think the demand for housing has always been pretty consistently high. The demand for housing in Detroit is not. So then you have to ask, how does this housing perform when the demand is not there? Why did Pruitt-Igoe get taken down? One of the theories is that what happened when that housing was built, again, in order to try to reduce costs, is sometimes they would build, for example, one elevator for a 20 or 30 story building, which was going to hold families with children. And there was no doorman, there was no easy access to the outdoors, there was no play space that could be monitored by children. There are people that have made whole careers out of studying this. One of them is Oscar Newman, who essentially went from public housing authority to public housing authority trying to retrofit. They were extremely difficult to retrofit. But indeed, they were ideally good housing. And I agree that there's nothing inherently wrong with high-rise housing, but they were never given a chance. The program was never given a chance.
Going right back
the cutbacks in public housing support began to happen in the 1970s. No question there were problems and complaints about public housing, high-rise public housing from the beginning. But the really widespread decline of public housing was accompanied by federal cutbacks in maintenance and support beginning under the Nixon administration when it was determined that it was better to provide low-income people with housing vouchers and place them in the private market. The kind of diagram that you see in a place like Brewster or in Cabrini-Green is the same diagram of housing on Lakeshore Drive. Put a couple of potted palms in front of the buildings, put a canopy, put a doorman, secure the building, and there'd be very little difference externally.
Why do you think someone hasn't come in with private money to do exactly that?
Well, that was exactly the theory of Oscar Newman, that the housing actually could hold middle class very well with a doorman. I think the issue is why, when the federal government a few years ago launched the Hope 6 program, which is essentially the effort that has torn down that housing and replaced it with something else, why does that housing look so very different? So I think if we look at more recent history in terms of what are we turning those public housing units into, then we could look at some examples maybe that have some mixtures. So, for example, the Jeffries project in Detroit, which looked very much like the Brewster projects, they were almost twins. The Jeffries were built for whites, and the Brewster Douglas were built for blacks. But essentially now the remaking of that, the Woodbridge Estates, is a mixture. So it's true, the high-rise housing has been rehabbed, and it's beautiful. They've put green roofs on it, and they put a clock tower, and they put seniors there because seniors are appropriate for that in Detroit. But they've also built townhouses. They've built a separate building for senior citizens. So I think the recognition now is that in most cities, really, if we have a choice, then what we want to do is to put some sort of mixture of housing types and certainly mixture of incomes. The problem with Douglas is there's no more federal money to do what was done with Jeffrey. So it isn't so much why doesn't the private sector do something. It's why haven't we as a nation put the public money into remaking of public housing where it needs to be remade, what needs to happen.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with June Manning Thomas and Roy Strickland, who are with the University of Michigan College of Architecture and Urban Planning, as we look at the history of the Brewster Douglas projects. And now looking ahead, we have this sizable site that is going to be cleared. What do you think would be the best use of that site?
So I think you have to look at where is this site situated. Mm-hmm. So it's south of the medical center. It's between Woodward and, of course, the Chrysler Expressway. It's very close to the Brush Park redevelopment area. And, of course, it's north of downtown. But Brush
and
Park.
And it's close to the stadiums.
It's close, but it's no closer than Brush Park. Okay. And Brush Park has not yet been redeveloped. It's partially done, mm-hmm. but it still has a long way to go. So I think we can dream and visualize mm-hmm. what it should become, but I think the market's going to have to strengthen a little bit more before we see some action. Now, I think the market is strengthening because I think if you look at the rental market, it's gone up. If you look at the rental market in terms of residential as well as office, that has gone up considerably in the last 3 years.
Yes.
So I think taking those towers down will hopefully open up some opportunities. But what those opportunities are, I think we may have to wait and see a bit until we see what the market will bear.
What do you think Detroit's leaders should be doing as they try to attract something for that site? What should be their charge?
I think they have to take things one step at a time. And so they have put out in the last 3 weeks an RFP mm-hmm. for the site to the west of that.
Mm-hmm. For Brush
That's
Park.
The Brush Park. So you can't really push the market if you're in a position such as the city of Detroit. They have no money to offer incentives. Yeah. I mean, they may have some tax money left mm-hmm. to kind of offer incentives. But I mean, in terms of CDBG dollars or whatever, they don't have that. So they're trying to basically stoke the private market. So if they can get the Brush Park to restart, then basically bring down from, of course, we haven't mentioned this, but the Brewster homes have actually been replaced. Those were replaced in the 80s, I believe it was, by the city. So the old townhouses that were there at one point have long been gone, and they now have new townhouses. So they'd have the medical center, they'd have the new townhouses, mm-hmm. they'd have the land that's now being cleared, all of this heading south, and then they'd have, of course, to the west, Brush Park and Woodward, and the market leaping across the expressway of the Central Business District, which Dan Gilbert is actively stoking with Rock Ventures.
And Roy, your thoughts on assuming that that parcel is going to be cleared, there it's going to be, what would you envision?
Well, I think June is pointing out nearby assets which can extend themselves into the area. Now, I'm an urban designer, so I tend to dance around with sugar plums in my head, and I suffer these design visions. June is the sober urban planner who deals with the facts and analysis and statistics. But as far as I know, there are four legs to the American city's economic future. I understand them as technology, medicine, education, and culture. And it appears that Brewster is near a few of those Detroit assets and might become a kind of crossing of them in creating a new subcenter for the city that combines these assets. Although I would hate to think that it only becomes a private venture for high-end individuals. I think we need to respect the history of what's come before and the people's energies that went into the building of that community, the energy of people who live there. We still have many, many low-income people who need housing. That whatever is built there has some component that reestablishes that very important history and service on the site.
Good thoughts and a good conversation. We've been talking with Roy Strickland, who's an urban designer, and June Manning Thomas, urban planner, both with the College of Architecture and Urban Planning at the University of Michigan. It has been a pleasure to talk with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Stateside. President Obama brought his campaign for a higher minimum wage to Michigan today. The president spoke this hour on the campus of the University of Michigan. And that's where Stateside Zoe Clark has been, listening to the president and gauging the reaction. Zoe, how long did the president speak and what did he say to the crowd?
Yeah, hi, Cindy. Well, the president spoke for, I would say, just about under half an hour. He got this crowd riled up, making some jokes, again, to a friendly crowd here in Ann Arbor. But he also definitely talked policy, of course, Cindy. That's why he's here, policy being an increase to the nation's minimum wage. As you mentioned, he's pushing for a higher minimum wage nationally. This dovetails nicely with a ballot initiative here in Michigan that's also, you know, pushing for an increase to the state's minimum wage from $7.40 an hour to $10.10 an hour by 2017.
And he also had some lunch at Zingerman's before he went. We had Paul Saginaw on the show earlier, so that was a nice salute to Mr. Saginaw.
He did. He gave a shout-out to our earlier guest, Paul Saginaw, saying that Zingerman's is a business to watch because they pay their workers above the national average, that they've managed to remain profitable. In fact, he actually had lunch there with Michigan Democratic Congressman Gary Peters, who, of course, is running for Senate. Peters ordered lunch after the president. The president said he would pay, and the president called the congressman a cheap date.
And I guess they enjoyed their Reubens. We know there were students who literally camped out since early Monday morning to get tickets to this presidential event. But, Zoe, who else was there?
Well, right, yes. Students were lined up. We talked to some of them before we came into the event, very excited. But, I mean, indeed, this is politics, right? So lots and lots and lots of Democratic officials in the audience. Besides Gary Peters, as I mentioned, who had lunch with the president and then followed him here, Mark Schauer is here, who's running for governor, as was Congressman John Conyers of Detroit, and Debbie Dingell, wife of retiring Dean of the House John Dingell. She, of course, is now running for his open seat.
And, of course, as you reminded us when we talked with you on yesterday's program, this is a huge election year in Michigan with big opportunities for the Dems. You've got a senator and three members of Congress not running for reelection. You've got the governor's seat and all the state legislature up for grabs. So there has to be, I'm guessing, a big chunk of politicking going on with this presidential appearance today in Michigan.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, of course, you know, the president is here pushing minimum wage, but there's a reason that he's coming to Michigan. There is a reason that he had lunch with Gary Peters, trying to raise the profile of Peters and this open Senate seat. It's an important race for national Democrats. Democrats, of course, are trying to keep control of the U.S. Senate in 2014, looking to maybe be a difficult task. So that shows how important this open seat is. Michigan is big for national Democrats this year. We had Vice President Joe Biden here in January.
Sure.
The president was at Michigan State University in February. He's here again now. And President Bill Clinton will be in Michigan later this month to fundraise. So, yes, important, important state. They are making that clear.
And you have some breaking political news for us this hour.
We do, Cindy. It's actually just been confirmed in about the last 30 minutes, although I'm not quite sure the campaign was ready to confirm it. Mark Schauer, who I mentioned earlier as he is running for governor, he's going to choose Oakland County Clerk Lisa Brown as his lieutenant governor on the Democratic ticket. You know, Brown plays into Democrats in the issue of the sort of so-called war on women. Brown was one of the female lawmakers who in 2012 was told to stop speaking on the House floor in a heated debate over abortion. Democrats have been looking to Oakland County. They want votes from Oakland County. They want a female candidate, one who can raise money. That indeed is Lisa Brown. And we should also note Lisa Brown, her name has been in the news recently. She was one of the four county clerks who officiated some of the state's gay marriages almost 2 weeks ago. So a choice for the Democrats now breaking on top of the big presidential visit.
Indeed. Stateside, Zoe Clark reporting from the president's visit at the University of Michigan. Thanks, Zoe.
Thanks, Cindy.
It was day two on Capitol Hill for General Motors CEO Mary Barra. Today it was the Senate's turn to grill Barra about GM's failure to act on ignition switch failures, a failure which has been linked to 13 deaths and prompted a recall of 2.6 million cars.
This is an extraordinary situation. It involves vehicles we no longer make. But it came to light on my watch, so it is my responsibility to resolve it.
Well, let's see how the day went. We're joined now by Washington reporter for the Detroit News, David Shepherdson. Good to have you with us back on the program, David.
Thanks for having me.
And joined by veteran auto analyst Michelle Krebs. Thanks for joining us, Michelle.
Glad to be here.
So, David, let me start with you. Did Mary Barra get a tougher questioning from senators today than she did from House members yesterday?
In a word, yes. I mean, it was brutal. I mean, the questions came fast and furious. One senator, Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire, accused the company of criminal deception. The chairman of the panel, Senator Claire McCaskill, said there was a culture of cover-up. And, you know, there wasn't a single senator from either party who defended GM or didn't subject the CEO to tough questioning. Even Senator Barbara Boxer invoked Mary Barra's gender and saying, as a woman to woman, I'm very disappointed. So it really came from all sides, and it was very tough. She looked pretty grim when she left the hearing, and unlike yesterday, she didn't answer any questions. She simply rushed into an elevator.
Do you think, Michelle, it's because the senators on the committee had a chance to kind of digest what happened yesterday with the House and decided that they were going to amp it up? What do you think was behind this?
Oh, I think so, because yesterday there was a lot of frustration afterwards that she kept saying, we have an investigation going on. I can't answer those questions. And what I felt today is there was some incredulousness about how could she possibly not know something was going on, considering all the important jobs. One senator even said, you know, you're an important person in this organization. How could you have not known something was going on? Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of discussion about, you know, criminal charges and why are the people still working there that whose names have appeared on the memos. It was, I thought, more detailed and grueling.
Well, this seems to be a fairly common theme to Mary Barra's answers to the committees yesterday and today. Let's take a quick listen here.
When we have answers, we will be fully transparent with you, with our regulators, and with our customers. While I can't turn back the clock, as soon as I learned about the problem, we acted without hesitation. We told the world we had a problem that needed to be fixed. We did so because whatever mistakes were made in the past, we will not shirk from our responsibilities now and in the future. Today's GM will do the right thing.
So let me ask both of you, and I'll start with you, David. Was that the best answer she could give them based on where things are now?
You know, Senator McCaskill told us afterward that she thought that Mary Barra had come in with a plan to basically not answer their questions. And I think she, you know, certainly got legal advice, and one of the things she certainly was trying to avoid was what would happen with Toyota. If you remember, just mm-hmm. a couple of weeks ago, Toyota agreed to pay a $1.2 billion criminal fine stemming from the statements it made in 2009 and 2010, including some before Congress, where the Justice Department said Toyota had given inaccurate facts to Congress. So there's a lot of pressure on her not to answer questions that the 6 million pages or so that GM has uncovered as part of their investigation could turn up later to be untrue. But that said, you know, there are other questions that the senators said that she could have answered that she shied away from. So, you know, there was a lot of irritation about that fact that she didn't answer more questions. You know, the ranking Republican Dean Heller from Nevada said, you know, I read the transcript and I saw you didn't really answer many questions. I'm sure you're not going to do that today either. So, no, I think they also extracted from her an agreement that she will come back to the committee to answer those questions someday once the investigation is over. So they're not letting go of this anytime soon.
What were your thoughts on that kind of, you know, that was seemed to be the page from the hymnal that she was singing from, Michelle? What were your thoughts?
Well, right, and she does have to be a little bit careful because there are all these lawsuits pending. And if she, you know, something she says that may not end up being correct after the investigation is done could come back to haunt them. So I could see why she was very careful. The other thing I think we have to remember, too, that a lot of times these congressional hearings aren't just about getting to the bottom of an issue. There's a lot of grandstanding and politicking and for the audience back home on these kinds of things. And well, that's not to diminish what they're doing. They're doing important work.
But. Well, in fact, I wanted to get the thoughts of both of you on the idea of the theater or the optics for the senators and the members of Congress. And to that point, let's take a listen to this question that came from Senator Barbara Boxer of California.
Okay, and then you were a plant manager of Detroit Hamtramck Assembly in 03 to 04, were you responsible for day-to-day plant activities related to safety, people, and quality? And still, you knew nothing about this.
We didn't build any of these models at the Detroit Hamtramck.
In that position, you knew nothing about this, correct?
Okay.
So what is supposed to be accomplished with questions like these?
Well, I thought that was an interesting one, too. Two thoughts on this. I thought the women were particularly, both yesterday and today, were particularly harsh on her. I thought that was kind of interesting. The other thing, and as we've seen this in other congressional hearings on automotive topics, there isn't a lot of knowledge about the auto industry.
Yeah.
The plant manager at Detroit Hamtramck, they're in their own little world. They may not know all that's going on. I understood her point was she's got this high position, but I don't think they realize how big these auto companies are and spread out.
Yeah. It just seemed like, what was the point of that question? I mean, did you get that sense at all, David?
I felt the exact same way. I mean, what those questions showed, and yesterday, is the senators and members of Congress who are not from Michigan have no real concept of the sheer size of a company like General Motors, you know, for better or worse. I mean, these are very, you know, the auto companies are very large, very bureaucratic, and, you know, a lot of people, like Mary Barr, prior to her career, have very lofty-sounding titles, but the reality is, unless you're in a narrow silo of the company involving safety and vehicle crash worthiness or the legal department, you know, chances are you never heard about this because it's just not the type of thing that rose, as far as we know, to the level of senior management because the company did not believe that this was a significant problem. I mean, as the documents show, the company had considered a fix for the ignition switch in 2005, but said it would have cost 90 cents per switch, but only saved, you know, 10 or 15 cents per switch in reduced warranty costs. So this is simply looked as like, hey, is there a business case to improve the part? But nobody, again, as far as we know, treated this as a safety problem. And that's a real question that the company has not yet been able to answer. But certainly, you know, politics, grandstanding in Congress, I'm shocked. I was shocked that the hearing wasn't all just a serious fact-finding mission, you know.
Well, let me ask both of you, when would be the time to march that engineer or that plant manager who really was hands-on in charge of the production of these involved vehicles, when's the time to march that person or those persons in front of Congress, knowing, as we've seen, Mary Barra was off, you know, tending other patches while this was evolving?
David, I don't know, and I think they absolutely have to complete that investigation because it isn't just one person, and
clearly
there are other people's names on the emails that were referred to, and they got to find out. To David's point, did they know this was, you know, a safety issue? What did they know? And is there just a lot to be known yet? And I think you can't build a timeline going forward yet.
I agree with Michelle. You know, these documents do look pretty bad, and the fact that this engineer reportedly did not remember signing this change in the part number, or the part in 2006, without a subsequent change in the part number seems very questionable. However, there were a lot of people involved in this. It was not just one person. And, you know, yes, GM at the time was facing, you know, very, you know, severe cost problems in 2005. You know, GM was in the middle of an endless series of plant closures and reductions in jobs. And everybody remembers how, you know, in that 4 or 5 year run up before the bankruptcy, you know, these companies were struggling to stay alive by slashing costs. But that said, you know, and again, we need to get to the bottom and we need to see the documents to know, did somebody within GM really connect all the dots, know this was a serious safety problem, that people were dying, or did they think this was simply, you know, a customer satisfaction issue? I mean, there are a lot of things that go wrong with cars that don't get fixed, they're not recalled. I mean, these are very complicated 4,000-part machines, and especially in that era, you know, there were more problems that were simply acceptable by the companies.
NHTSA is also in the congressional hot seat for not acting in what Congress sees as a timely manner on, what, some 260 complaints. So who was there from NHTSA, David, and how was that person treated?
So that's the acting NHTSA administrator, David Friedman, who only took over as the the chief of the agency 2 months ago, and he was named the deputy a little less than a year ago. So the most difficult question they have been faced with is that in September of 2007, a senior NHTSA investigator proposed to his superiors that the agency open a formal investigation, citing the fact that they had reports of four fatal crashes of now recalled Cobalt. But the agency ultimately decided not to open a formal investigation, saying that the trend data for Cobalt problems was not much higher than the other vehicles, which is surprising given that the agency is so aggressive in opening investigations in some cases when no one's been injured or only one crash or just one complaint. Given that there was this number of fatalities, the agency has not really given us a good answer except to say that just after they made the decision not to open the investigation, the results of an individual investigation into one of these crashes came back, and it confirmed that there was a link between the non-airbag deployment and the ignition switch being in the wrong position. But by that point, they had moved on to other issues and never went back to the problem. So, you know, the agency only has 51 people. They only spend $10 million a year on auto safety when we've got, as a country, 250 million vehicles on the road. So there's a lot of pressure in Congress that maybe the agency needs more money and perhaps more authority to do its job.
Any timetable for her return appearance on Capitol Hill?
It depends on when GM's internal investigation wraps up, which could be as soon as the next couple months.
And final few seconds, Michelle, what most should happen right now to get General Motors through this crisis and regain consumer confidence?
Well, they've got to keep on doing some of the things they've been doing. As soon as there's an issue, address it. And they've got to be in a culture that they pay close attention to this kind of thing and act quickly. They're making money now, so that's not an excuse. And if they're truly going to prove that they've changed the culture, those are the kinds of things they have to be proactive.
Auto analyst Michelle Krebs and David Shepardson, the Washington correspondent for the Detroit News. Always good to talk with both of you. Thank you so much today.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Today's engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.